Good day. Good day. I'm Jeff Shepherd, and I'm here to welcome you on behalf of the Nixon Foundation to another in our series of Nixon Legacy Forums. I believe this is our 13th forum over the course of the past 2 years. We co-sponsor these with the National Archives, and in a nice way, they have the documents, we have the heads, we have the people who wrote the documents, and it's a way of bringing texture and context for future scholars and researchers to better understand the whys and the wherefores that went into the creation of these documents. And we're terribly pleased to be doing this with National Archives, and we think they're pleased to be doing it with us. Our host today is the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's most appropriate that we be here, not only because they've supplied the facility, but because, as you will soon learn, several of the participants are closely associated with CSIS. And while energy crisis may mean to some people just the price of gas at the pump, it has international defense, foreign affairs implications every bit as much as domestic. My job is to introduce the moderator. But before I do that, we have come across a really fun little segment of President Nixon himself speaking on September 26, 1971 at the Hanford Breeder Reactor in the state of Washington. And he's introducing people, and it's during the campaign, and he's relaxed and at ease, and it's an interesting shot. So if we can run that segment, we'll show you President Nixon introducing his energy team.
We have also the biggest man in the President's cabinet, the Secretary of Interior, Rogers Martin. See? You see what I mean? My football coach, Chief Newman, used to say he's big enough to go hunt bear with a switch. And we also have the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, the new chairman, who succeeded Dr. Seaberg, Dr. James Schlesinger. And then two of the top members of the president's staff, these are people you've read about and heard about. Mr. John Ehrlichman, who comes from the state of Washington, Seattle, and who heads up the domestic council. John Ehrlichman. Incidentally, you think that Governor Evans is a lobbyist for Hanford in the Tri-City area. You ought to hear Ehrlichman. He is all out. And then another man that I'm sure you've heard about who's enormously interested in this matter. I understand, incidentally, Dan Evans told me that it was once said that more PhDs lived in this area than any area of the United States. That was at least the case a few years ago, and probably there's still as many per square acre or mile as the case may be. Well, we have a very famous PhD on our staff, Dr. Henry Kissinger, our advisor for international affairs.
So there you have it, a little film clip from out of the past. And as you know, Dr. Schlesinger is here with us this morning, young and spry, and you know, time has stood still for all of us. It was only 4 decades ago. Our moderator today is Guy Caruso, and I'm going to turn it over to him. He's had 30 years of experience in wrestling with energy issues. He was actually the Middle East oil analyst at the Office of Economic Research at the CIA during the Nixon administration. So if you're into conspiracy theories, you can start with Guy. He's currently senior advisor here for energy and national security programs at CSIS. And in between, he spent a lot of time at the Departments of Energy and the International Energy Agency in Paris, France. So we have an excellent moderator who in turn will introduce the other speakers. Guy?
Thank you very much, Jeff. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to see so many longtime friends and to be part of this panel today. I think there's a feedback on here, shoot. Okay, yeah. Well, my job today is to set the scene and then let the policymakers during the Nixon administration, who we have with us today, really give us their reflections. But just to remind everyone, when President Nixon came into office in January 1969, the backdrop was one in which the country still was in considerable turmoil, rioting from 1968, demonstrations still raging over Vietnam. The economists were wrestling with the low growth scenario with high inflation, so-called stagflation. There were concerns about the trade and currency reform. And the Democrats, although they had lost the presidential election, a very close election, had captured both the House and the Senate, which of course come to play as we talk about Nixon attempts to get legislation passed on energy. He was the first president to really take on energy as a critical issue, and he did so early on in the famous speech that we'll talk more about in June of 71. He also did a number of things on the environmental side, and Jim Schlesinger was saying to me earlier, he was the first environmental president. Created EPA, passage of what's now known as NEPA, National Energy and Environment Policy Act, extensions of Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, all played into this picture of energy. He proposed a number of things in his first energy speech, many of which we continue to talk about today. Energy efficiency, more energy R&D, renewables, clean coal, the creation of a department that would consolidate energy under a Department of Natural Resources. All of those things were in that first speech. And domestically, the situation here was one in which the United States was one of the largest oil producers in the world at that time, but that was soon to change, as the first chart shows what happened with U.S. oil production. It reached its highest level in 1970 and has gone down more or less steadily for almost 40 years. We're now seeing, just now, after 40 years, seeing a little bit of a tick back. But the main thing to point out here is U.S. domestic industry was at its highest level of production in 70. Demand was rising in a controlled price environment, pressing up against limited supplies, and our imports were increasing, which caused concern even as far back as the Eisenhower administration, when the mandatory oil import program limited the amount of oil imports. Oil prices were relatively stable. And the next chart shows that the price of gasoline is a mid 35, 36 cents for most of the first few years until the embargo-induced increase in prices. So these are the kinds of things that were happening in the domestic energy in period 1969, 70, 71, leading up to the embargo. And as today, then as now, we had regional politics playing an important role, with the producer states, of course, pushing for protection from rising Middle Eastern oil imports, and had a couple good politicians by the name of Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson very much lobbying for that in the 60s, and they were successful. We also had Northeastern congressmen from mostly consuming states saying we need to control prices. And indeed, in the middle part of 1971, wage and price controls were imposed to deal with broader inflation, but also to deal with energy prices. On the international scene, the Arab-Israeli and Palestinian issue continued to fester all the way back, could even go back to the Suez Canal crisis, 56, 57, but there was a 1967 war in which Israel completely dominated the Arab forces, and it was somewhat of I think it stuck in the craw of the leaders then, and it certainly played a role in what was to become the Yom Kippur War of 1973. OPEC was beginning to show increased power to set prices, manifested by a couple of agreements. One called the Tripoli Agreement, followed by a Tehran Agreement. Those were in 70, 71, and the key price hawks were the Shah of Iran and a young colonel by the name of Gaddafi, who was part of that story back in 1970, 71. U.S. maintained very close relations with Shah, of course, and with King Faisal in Saudi Arabia. But there was no mechanism for consuming countries so that these energy issues continued to mount, and the president continued to call for legislation from Congress to deal with energy prices, energy production, and all the way from that period after his first speech in 71, all the way up to just before the embargo. He had speeches in April of 73, in the middle part of 1973, again imploring Congress to pass legislation to create a new department, to increase funding for R&D. And in the summer of 73, he announced the appointment. Being frustrated by Congress inaction, he announced administratively the creation of an energy policy office and appointed former Governor John Love to head up that office. He was the first sort of so-called energy czar. Also brought in a special consultant by the name of Charles de Bona at that same time. And it was also a prominent role given to Treasury official William Simon, who directed the Oil Policy Committee. All of this was happening just prior to the Yom Kippur War of 6 October 1973. And the Arab leaders were particularly unhappy with the United States because of our support of Israel and the continued support when it looked like Israel might even lose that war. That led to the imposition of an oil embargo by the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries, OAPEC, on the 20th of October. Then the president made what is now called the Project Independence speech in November of 1973, calling on the United States to mobilize and to make sacrifices to reduce consumption to deal with this embargo and subsequent oil production cutback. He listed a number of specific things, which I'm not going to go into because I think some of our panelists today will. But it was basically an administrative response to this crisis. He created more formally the Federal Energy Office at that time and requested Congress to formally set up a Federal Energy Administration. This was in November of 1973. At that time, he appointed Bill Simon, to head up the Energy Emergency Response Coordinating Committee in the White House. And his deputy at that time was John Sawhill, later to become the head of FEA. Both Governor Love and Mr. de Bona submitted their resignations at this time, obviously signaling some disarray within that policymaking group. Internationally, the president invited fellow heads of state from consuming countries, the major consuming countries at that time, of course being mainly Europe and Japan, to send their foreign ministers to Washington to a Washington Energy Conference in February of 1974, which was chaired by Henry Kissinger and was to lead to the formation of the, what we now know as the International Energy Agency. There were a number of actions that were taken administratively, but Congress never did really pass a comprehensive energy bill or even a bill to respond to the crisis that had it had any meaningful components to it. Now, the after the Washington Energy Conference of February 1974, Congress finally did move and create the Federal Energy Administration. Its first administrator was John Sawhill. And the turn to deal with some of the skepticism that existed among the public and even in Congress about the how real this crisis really was. Many said, oh, companies were just withholding the oil, get the price to rise. Windfall profits tax was proposed but never passed. The president asked the then FEO to audit oil companies to look into allegations of price gouging. That may sound familiar. So what, let me conclude by saying, I think that the president deserves a lot of, President Nixon deserves a lot of credit for taking on this issue at a time when there was not a lot of public support or even understanding of the energy scene. The majority of Americans at that time were not even aware that the U.S. imported any oil, so they were shocked to find out we were embargoed and that made a difference. Obviously, the allocation of oil through the voluntary allocation program that later became mandatory, which Jim Tozzi is very familiar with, was part of the reason we had the long lines in 1973-74, and that clearly was an unpleasant environment for politicians who then had to ask constituents to make sacrifices. And again, the president didn't get much as much support as I think he deserved for doing that. So with that kind of overview, I think it's also interesting to note that even in recent speeches, as recently as 2009, President Obama mentioned that President Nixon was the first president to take this on and use that, of course, to say, here we are 40 years later with many of these same issues. And only a couple weeks ago, Governor Perry and his campaign talked about self-sufficiency. And the Project Independence report that President's Project Independence speech of November of 73 led to this tome that the Federal Energy Agency produced about a year later. And here today we have three very distinguished panelists to discuss their perspectives, all very different roles, but insightful parts of the Nixon Energy and national security response to the scene that I've just set. We're going to start off with Ambassador Richard Fairbanks, who served that specifically during his time as the in the White House as a senior domestic policy advisor on energy, environment, and natural resources. He'll be followed by James Tozzi, who served as a senior manager in chief of the Environment Bureau in the Office of Management and Budget, and especially knowledgeable about the regulatory issues that came up during these during this time. And finally, Dr. James R. Schlesinger, Sr., served three roles during the Nixon administration. First, as we saw, chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, then became director of Central Intelligence, and was named Secretary of Defense in 1973 and dealt with the energy issues from a national security perspective. So we'll start with Ambassador Fairbanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Guy. For those who are literarily inclined, you may remember the quotation, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." That was written, for those of you who don't remember, about two cities, called A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. What you may not know is the two cities were Washington and Riyadh. That's what I remember anyway. But we're going to talk about three things today, my fellow panel members and I. And they are three things that were thrust upon President Nixon and his administration by, first of all, his being a little ahead of his time and seeing the issue, as you heard, gave the first energy speech by any president in 1971, and then by the exigencies of what happened with the war and its aftermath in 1973 with its domestic and international implications. And so the president and his administration had to deal with three sets of problems. They had to deal with, starting from ground zero, policy and the personnel and institutions. And so as you'll hear in the course of these remarks, all three of those took a lot of the president's time and attention, so much though that in 1974, in his State of the Union speech, his final State of the Union speech, he said the number one problem facing this country is energy. So we came a long way. Well, as you heard, and as you saw in the original opening film clip there, the president's chief domestic policy advisor was John Ehrlichman, a lawyer from Seattle, Washington. And we have a picture of Ehrlichman. I can't tell from up there. There's John. And John Ehrlichman was a very fascinating person. After he went through the debacle of Watergate and what happened to him and going to jail and all those things, he ended up writing novels and working for a little company called Law Engineering down in Atlanta. And my first brush with John Ehrlichman was when I got shanghaied over from the brand new Environmental Protection Agency to join the domestic policy staff working for John Ehrlichman. And after about a year of that, in 1972, right after the election, during the election, of course, all the bureaucrats like me were asked to put in our resignations, and then if they weren't picked up, to say what we'd like to do if we stayed. And so I put in mine, and I said what I'd like to do is to move over to the Department of Defense and hopefully become Deputy Secretary of the Navy. Being a former naval officer, I thought that'd be kind of neat. And my boss, John Whitaker, said he'd be happy to stay in the administration, but only if he got to stay in his current role as a White House staffer. And of course, government being government, John Whitaker was shipped out to the Interior Department, and I stayed in the White House, took his job. And so John Ehrlichman, right after the 1972 election, called me into his office, and he says, this energy stuff, I think it requires a little more attention we've been giving to it, because we didn't have anybody specifically worrying about it, domestic policy staff. He says, take a look at it and tell me what you think. And so I went off for a few days, and I came back, and I said, darn right, John, this is important stuff, and it's so important that I think we need more than 10% of my time. And he said, well, you can go hire a couple of people. I said, geez, that's the first time anybody ever told me I could hire somebody. So I went over to State Department, hired one fellow who was supposed to be expert on the international side, and one to the Interior Department, and took a young, obscure PhD from the Interior Department to focus on the domestic side. And the international side was a fellow named Jim Akins. I don't know if he's going to come up over there, who subsequently became U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And on the domestic side, I don't know if you ever heard of him because he was lost in the mists of history. He set up a company called Enron. His name was Ken Lay. So we all have roots and we all have histories. There are theirs. Now you heard from Brother Caruso here that the first office that was designated to worry about energy, other than us little staffers, was headed by Governor Love, the former governor of Colorado. And he had Charles DeBona, subsequently the head of the American Petroleum Institute, as his chief of staff. And Governor Love and Charlie lasted for about the first 6 months of that focused energy side. And it was an important and a very fast-moving 6 months. One of the key pieces of legislation, you heard that the president submitted a lot of pieces of legislation. We'll hear more about that as time goes forth. But one of the key pieces of legislation was the first one that Congress actually passed at the President's request that actually made a difference, and that was the legislation to build the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. That was a very contentious issue. The President's request for legislation came up right in the middle of the national furor about the Arab oil embargo, and it was a very hot time politically because, of course, environment was riding high. People's attention was focused because of the energy question on increasing domestic energy supply, and the two were seen to collide in this particular piece of legislation. I remember sitting in Senator Ted Stevens' office. Senator Ted Stevens, of course, was from the state of Alaska and a big supporter, therefore, of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And that day, the New York Times had a little cartoon on the front page. And the cartoon was a small picture of the state of Alaska. And they had this big black line running down the middle of the cartoon. And it says, this is the proposed Alaska pipeline. And Senator Stevens, of course, was outraged because he said, no, wait a second. If the state of Alaska were the same size as an 18-hole golf course, the Trans-Alaska pipeline would be like running a thread across the golf course, not like this big black line. And so he thought they were weighting the public opinion against him. So we go into battle, and Ted Stevens proposes a one-sentence piece of legislation, which I, as a young lawyer, I think drafted. And it basically said, enough of these environmental impact statements. We've done enough of them. No more judicial review. What's done now is sufficient. And the Congress, therefore, says, let's move forward and build the darn thing. So it comes up to the vote in the Senate, and the vote was 49-49. And so the first and only time in his long and distinguished career as Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew cast his one vote to break the tie in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Little known facts. Now, finally, as we move forward, I will turn this over to my friends and colleagues here. As you heard again from Guy, the first actual office, formal office, established by executive order by the President was the Federal Energy Office. People said, why'd you call it the Federal Energy Office? Office of Energy Policy would be pretty snappy. And I remember sitting in Mel Laird's office. Mel was then a senior counselor, the senior counselor to the President, having been Secretary of Defense. And Mel says, yeah, Office of Energy Policy sounds good. I said, wait a second. We have just ended last week the career of the Office of Emergency Preparedness, OEP. And all the bureaucrats throughout Washington will be terribly confused if the next week we come up with a new OEP. This will never work. He said, what should we call it? I said, Federal Energy Office. So that's what it became. That was headed initially, as you heard, formally by Deputy Secretary of Treasury Simon, and staffed by John Sawhill, who had been from the Office of Management and Budget. And they took up the reins of dealing with this issue full time, of which we'll hear more because there were three presidential speeches in 1973. There were a number more in 1974, and concluding with the veto of some legislation that finally got through the Congress, supposedly addressing the energy question, which the President didn't like. So there's a lot more to this story. I hope I've whetted your appetite, and I'll be happy to turn it over to Jim Tozzi.
Thank you. I guess I'm wired. I'm to speak on the regulatory aspects as well. My good friend Jim and Richard were making policy. My colleagues and I in OMB, policy doesn't mean anything if it doesn't get into regulations that run the private sector and the public sector. So we're on the receiving end of this, and I'll give you some of my discussions. Prior to that, I'd like to make one other point. And I'm going to describe the President's regulatory program on energy. But there's a point I need to make is that up to the time that President Nixon came aboard, the only two people that really had anything to do with regulating regulators were the courts and the Congress. And the President Nixon established a process called a quality of life review that really was the first administrative attempt to regulate the regulators. And up to now, he's gotten very little credit for that. And I refer you to the forthcoming article in the Administrative Law Review, which is a joint publication of the American University and the ABA, where there's going to be a lot on that. And for the first time, the Nixon administration that really set the stage for regulating regulators will get its due credit. Now, when I go into the regulatory aspects of of what the Nixon administration did, is that I'm reminded, I spoke on regulations in New Orleans around a year ago, and I have a number of friends that are musicians down there, and a couple of them attended my speech, and they said, you know, after you speak with regulations, it's looking like, it's like watching paint dry. So just stick with me a few minutes, because this stuff is somewhat detailed and is not the sexiest, but without regs, none of the policies that my colleagues here made really works. I'm going to give you a few things that the Nixon administration did are very bold, very controversial, but they're also against a backdrop. We had an oil embargo and we're getting short of oil, so you have to transpose the events of that day into some of these regulatory actions I'm going to describe. I would put them in four categories. Regulatory relief, conservation, crude oil, price control, and allocation of products. In terms of regulatory relief, the administration really went out and wanted the OCS out of continental shelf to be developed, and there was a huge amount of redundancy in the regulatory structure. And I think they approached that, the administration, including me, approached that and all the staff at OMB and the agencies, by the way, and cleaned those cobwebs. The other big thing that I did on regulatory relief, well before shale oil ever became an issue, there was enough thinkers, particularly at the career level in the government, that said shale deposits were going to be a big issue, and we have to set a precedent for a licensing and regulatory structure on shale, which was done with the approval of my colleagues to my right and left. On conservation and standards and guidance, there was a huge number of proposals, more than you could ever imagine, because you thought we were out there drilling all the time. We weren't. There were proposals for speed limits, for insulation, decorative lighting, office hours, thermostat control, daylight saving times, gas mileage, appliance labeling. A lot of them were enacted, some weren't, some were expired after a couple years, but there was a reasonable push on conservation. I don't think it gets quite as much credit as it does, should. Now let's get into price regulation. Now, anyone that's an economist has some biases as you do, so you're gonna have to put my bias of being an economist. Most economists are not very hep on price regulation, and maybe during the discussion, my colleagues here can add to the discussion how a very conservative president named Richard Nixon would come up with price controls. That's a story in itself. But let me tell you basically what it did. It was an amazing thing because around August 15th of the year, all my bosses went out to Camp David, and when they came back, we had price control. So I don't know exactly how all that worked, but it worked. So they announced a very amazing program. We said it had four phases, or not now, it developed into four phases. The first one was a 90-day mandatory freeze across the economy on wage and prices. It was absolutely amazing to try to implement. It had 90 days. Then after that, we went into phase two, and phase two had the same controls, but we relaxed them in one way. We said anyone that is producing goods and products subject to wage and price and control, we will let your costs go through, pass through your costs, with the exception of energy. We did not deregulate that portion of the energy. We went to phase three, and during that point in time, there started to be a small increase in heating oil prices, which got the Congress and all the politicians quite concerned. We then moved to phase three, and that's where it really got heavily. First, we made it voluntary for a couple months. The increase in price of heating oil went really high, and in the entire Washington, not only President Nixon, the Congress, the consumer groups, everyone was pushing for price control. So you can't say it was just a Nixon thing. You can't imagine the number of people in Washington of both sides of the aisle that wanted this huge thing of price control. Well, we put it in, and we made really a gargantuan rule called Special Rule Number 1, which set price limitations on the majors of the oil companies, and we really tied them down. And finally, we went to phase four, and I think we made the biggest mistake in the history of the program. That is where we limited the price of domestic crude to $4.25 a barrel. And I think the implications of that decision was absolutely astounding. So then when we did all the price allocations, what happened? The market wasn't working. It needed Band-Aids. More than Band-Aids, it needed major surgery. And so what happened is the Congress passed the Emergency Petroleum Allocation Act. We had a huge act that gave unfettered authority to allocate products. And some people think it's just crude oil. We allocated we had the authority for products in addition to the crude on mammoth regulatory program. And if you look at the regs, pages and pages of details, what is and when, how do you measure the oil? I mean, it was making people outside of government that left, like Richard, very wealthy doing all that stuff. And so so what was the impact of this program, of the price control and the allocation? In my opinion, it was absolute chaos. I don't think any social good that I know really came as a result of that program. I think it was a nosedive into confusing activity with accomplishment. It didn't come, and me and a lot of people really wrote treatises on this. It said it increased prices, created shortages, changed the economic structure of an entire industry, and increased U.S. dependence on imported oil. Not very many positives on that list. Now, with that, the end result is that this, and that's why I think it's good to have legacy forms like this. And on one hand, I think it's good because you learn from history. On the other hand, my view is Americans have a big disdain for history. I don't see very many in policy and government ever look back more than 6 months. Republicans are Democrat. So the idea that you're doing this may have some impact. But let me close with one last point. Even when we went through this episode, you would think that in the short run, people would look at what we learned from price control and the allocation system. And what occurred? The policymakers, and I don't mean in the administration, in the Congress and the public, said, price control didn't work. But you know what will work? We'll put windfall profit taxes on, because if the prices go up, we'll recoup the difference in that. So what happened? President Nixon recommended a windfall profit tax, didn't pass. President Ford recommended one that didn't pass. President Carter recommended one and did pass. And if you read two federal studies on the Nixon price control, the conclusions of it, and I'll be finished in a second, a GAO said the price control program Carter administration was passed, is the largest and most complex tax ever levied on U.S. history. Congressional Research Study did it and said the windfall profits tax depressed the domestic production and extraction industry and furthered our dependence on sources of oil. So in conclusion, I think one thing, if anyone, another generation, looks at this legacy form, I would hope they would say that if you're going to intervene in the markets to make a federal mandate of mandating the differential price between domestic produced crude and that coming from foreign crude, you better do it very diligently, because everybody that tried it before you failed. Thank you.
Fellow historians, I am reminded the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, you're right.
If one looks at the Nixon speech in January of 71, it's all there. The Bible tells us there is nothing new under the sun. All of the items that have been discussed in energy policy through subsequent administrations can be found in that speech, including windfall profits tax, gasification of coal, liquefaction of coal, the coal conversion program, more emphasis on R&D. Subsequently, the energy independence, about which we have been hearing now for 60 or 70 years, and price controls, mandatory allocation, energy efficiency, conservation. That is the menu that has been used by all subsequently. Different presidents have chosen different pieces of that menu. Now, that was not the first energy crisis that we faced. That goes back to 1956 at the time of the closing of the Suez Canal after the British-French invasion of Egypt. At that time, the crisis was minimal because the United States had so much shut-in capacity that it could tide Britain and France, all of Europe as a matter of fact, over with that by opening up the unused capacity that was limited under state statutes. The 1967 war had a similar impact. But the 71 speech was the first comprehensive look at all the alternatives that we could use, good ones and bad ones, to deal with what was becoming an energy problem. The American public found it difficult to believe that the United States had a problem. And that was driven home by the 73 crisis. In 1973, I was a Secretary of Defense, sitting at my desk, looking at cables, and the top cable was one from the Exxon Corporation that stated, due to the orders of His Excellency Ahmed Zaki Yamani, we must cut off supplies of oil to the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean and to your forces in Europe. I was more astonished than angry. Congress was more angry than astonished. Subsequently passed legislation making it a criminal offense for American companies to obey the dictates of foreign countries, directed precisely against the Arab oil embargo. When I was AEC chairman, I had gone to see the president and said, Mr. President, we have an organization that is devoted to pushing one energy import, nuclear power. But what the country is really interested in is energy output. And the United States ought to be working on R&D across the entire energy spectrum to find out which of the various energies was most cost effective from the standpoint of the American citizen. We subsequently had IRDA, the Energy Research and Development Organization, that moved away from the prior emphasis on nuclear power. And of course, years later, we had the accident at Three Mile Island, which moved us a great deal further away from nuclear power. That's not to say anything about Japan, tsunamis, and what the impact is on nuclear power. Amongst the things that we inherited from that period is energy independence. Energy independence at that time was a myth. And it continues to be a myth that is dangled before the American people. We are never going to have energy independence until such time as we get off the internal combustion engine and move away from aircraft mobility, because we are dependent on liquid fuels for our automotive fleet. Energy independence talked about gross energy. It included nuclear energy, coal, and so on. But the fact is that producing more electric power under present circumstances does not give us energy independence. That depends upon liquid fuels and the United States does not produce and will not produce sufficient fuels to satisfy our public demand. Beating up on the oil companies doesn't really solve that problem. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. Everyone has mentioned that first speech in June of 71, and there was no formal structure, as you pointed out, Dick, a very small group of people, maybe even, not even a group, doing energy in June of 71. But yet, that, as Jim pointed out, it contained the menu that really hasn't changed that much in 40 years. Can you go into a little insight into how they came up with that? I mean, somebody must have, who were the key actors in putting that speech together?
Well, I'm happy to say I was not present at that creation. I didn't arrive until the end of June.
Okay.
And so I know it was the Domestic Council and OMB were the prime movers, but you were there, Jim. What do you think?
Well, I was at that time a little higher than my pay grade because I was still reviewing these boring regulations. But the OMB drafted a range of options that went through the deliberative process within OMB, but I don't know the director was involved, but I don't know exactly who played in that game.
Well, on the Domestic Council side in the White House, John Ehrlichman, as I said, was head of the Domestic Council, but his chief person, the associate director in this area, was John Whitaker, who I mentioned subsequently went to the Interior Department, and it was his area to worry about the Domestic Council staff, and so he would be the one who would have carried the baton on.
But Jim was there as associate director right before it started.
At OMB.
Yeah, at OMB.
I was talking about Domestic Council.
Yeah.
I know it was, even back then, a year before the next election, the 1972 election, we just had come out of a extremely tight presidential election between President Nixon and the challenger, the Minnesota congressman, Humphrey.
Humphrey, that was 68.
So here we are.
72, it was not a tight election.
Yeah.
True.
But he's faced with House and Senate controlled by Democrats. Mm-hmm. You have rising prices of energy. This was before price controls. They were August, as Jim pointed out, August of 71. Did politics play? At least from your perspectives, obviously politics must have played an important role in this first energy speech.
Well, politics only plays a role I think, any area of presidential involvement that depends on oxygen. Because obviously the White House, my theory of government is easy questions get handled by GS-11s, hard questions get handled by deputy assistant secretaries, and harder and harder and harder, when they come up to be too hard to handle, they get kicked out up to the White House, and the White House flips a coin. And did very tough ones get up there, and they're purely political, or they would be handled by people down the food chain. And so clearly, the ones that the president and his staff have to deal with are the ones that are very, very difficult to deal with. And I always thought that the most important thing when it gets up to that level is not to worry so much and have an ulcer as to whether you're right or wrong, but to make the decision and move on to something else.
I would like to comment. I was really enthralled with the idea of price controls. And let me give you my understanding, a little bit of the history of the price control. There's an Economic Stabilization Act that was passed in 1970, and it gave all these organic authorities to the president to implement. But they never thought a Republican president was going to use it, in my mind. And so it was out there a couple of years, and all at once these shortages started to occur. And in my view, just because I didn't sit with it at that time or later, but not that at that time, I didn't sit around in the Roosevelt room, but what happened was, my understanding was Governor John Connally was very interested in the idea right before the election that prices were increasing, there was no control, and he went, and he, I think it's John was Secretary then, Treasury, yeah. And I think his view was, at least my understanding is his view was, you know, we got to show some bold action, and we got to control these prices. And however, the decision process went up to the president, and it came out, yes. But when it came out, surprisingly, the whole town of Washington was for it. It wasn't just they didn't like it. I mean, you had consumer groups applauding this intrusion in the, I mean, and you had members of Congress, and a couple times they'd get letters into OMB saying we're not controlling the prices or the cost of the living costs. So I think the introduction of price controls was, although it was done under President Nixon, I think it was more of a societal thing. People really liked it, and that's why we implemented it.
But the other thing at that time that everybody was clamoring for, governors, mayors, various members of Congress of both parties, even some within the administration, as we got into the crunch of the so-called Arab oil embargo, was to have a program of rationing, formal rationing. And the president, President Nixon, had been involved with the OPA in a prior life, and he thought that rationing was the end of the world stupidity. And so he stood up against it, even though across the board and across the political spectrum of the United States, people were in favor of it. So there was one where he did not go the way the river was flowing, although we found, I didn't even know it at the time, subsequently found out that actually we had rationing coupons printed, but of course we went to the rationing by standing in line, and the rationing by buy gasoline on weekends, and pleading with people to drive more slowly and things like that. But happily, we didn't go to rationing. 50 miles per hour. Yes, indeed, the trucker's delight.
But on that allocation, there was a story that would go around. We'd come out of meetings that President Nixon had worked in the one of the OPA, whatever it was, and he saw firsthand something about the Curtis Candy Company, where they made candy bars, and they were putting price controls during the war. And what the Curtis Candy Company did, they kept the price, but made the candy bar smaller. And they said that the president had this bad taste about this allocation. And Richard's quite right. He was never overly for it, but he signed a bill, came out of the Congress. In essence, I'm pretty sure if he didn't sign it, it would have been overturned. There was this clamoring because they said the heating oil was going up, these shortages were coming about. And for some reason, the entire town of D.C. thought a bunch of people in a couple of offices in 17th Street and around could allocate all of these goods and services without any, I mean, it was amazing. And it failed.
The damned oil companies were told, stop producing that much gasoline, switch over to heating oil. So the U.S. government could decide on the allocation within refineries. The price controls were not as bad as mandatory allocation. That was really stupid, and it continued to be a problem all the way through, because allocation becomes purely a political matter. Whoever has the most clout gets more allocation. Now, in those days, it was the truckers that came into demanding results. They also came in during the fall of the Shah. They were still around and demanding special allocations for truckers. At that time, we had urged the White House, by all means, stay away from allocation. Don't give in. And we had this young woman who represented the White House in meeting with the truckers. And she had instructions, no allocation. At the end of it, we got the word, start allocating fuel. Why? You were told not to do it. Answer, she was about 5'2". She said, you've never sat in the room with these people who are 6'6", with necks that are as thick as a tree. threatening you. He said, oh, you just go along with them. And that's the way we got into allocation in at a later period.
So the question is it worse to be a sexist or a sizist?
Well, I'll just go back to boring regs. What he said is...
Let me finish up on the price controls. A freeze is not so bad if it's temporary, but circumstances change. And what happened was that the freeze was imposed when oil prices in the Middle East were $2 a barrel. Pretty soon, as a result of the 73 war, oil prices worldwide were $13 a barrel, and we were trying to hold prices down. Well, this created an enormous temptation for the industry later on to distinguish between old oil and new oil. And if you could move from the category of old oil to new oil, you made a lot of money. But it was the price gap that was the real problem. And an immediate freeze, if you take it off quickly enough, is tolerable. Less than ideal, but tolerable.
And that was also true, I think, of natural gas, wasn't it? We have old gas and new gas, or different categories.
Natural gas was a problem of the Supreme Court of the United States in the Phillips decision.
But I remember you were talking about allocation. Allocation was not just to truckers. You remember allocation was also regional. And of course, the people in the Northeast said, wait a second, those guys down there in Texas, Louisiana, where the Bruce's stuff, they were drowning in it, they got plenty of supply, it doesn't cost them much. We're up here freezing in the dark in New England. And I remember President Nixon brought a wide-ranging congressional group in, and he was trying to convince them that the way to go was to deregulate prices, which would raise domestic supply over time, and both get it allocated better and more efficiently, and increase our domestic supply and diversify our supply. And we have this long presentation, and sitting to the president's right was the senior member of the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, one Tip O'Neill. And Tip O'Neill, the president turns to him and he says, Tip, what'd you think of that presentation? The speaker says, Mr. President, that was a very persuasive argument you've just made, and I think intellectually I might even be convinced by it, but as you pointed out, it'll take 10 years for these policies to be felt, and I've got 5 elections between now and then.
Yeah, but I was saying, on the labyrinth of the regs, they were so complex and so big that the policymakers on one of this would say, we're going to reduce the prices and get out of price control. But under the bushes, we'd have a bunch of regs like Special Order Number 1 that controlled the prices of all the majors. And so, as he said, there's a differential between the two prices of domestic and foreign oil. And what happened was, is that when we did that, the domestic oil guy says, I'm not making any money out of doing the domestic stuff. I will start trying to get it, selling it in the other markets. And what happened was Sunoco came in and said, I can't play this game because I can't pay these prices to compete in these markets. And so what they did, they said, we can't play in the markets. We're not going to play this game. We're not. So every time you fixed one portion of the regs, there was something other than these thousands of regs that bit you. It
wasn't the Northerners who said we're freezing in the dark. It was the Southerners who put stickers on and said, let the damn Yankees freeze in the dark. It was a renewal of the Civil War.
Jim Tozzi, you mentioned about the complications, and Jim Schlesinger talked about how difficult it was to allocate and ultimately becomes a political decision. But what was the source? Somewhere there must have been a source of data by which you based these allocations. Oh, yeah. And it wasn't an EIA then, so.
No, what happened is that we had, by that time, FEMA, okay, not FEMA, yeah, Federal Energy Administration, and they inherited the organic statutes or the Economic Stabilization Act. We then abolished the price control program, but we didn't abolish it all because the Emergency Petroleum Act had absolutely huge authorities on price control allocation. They did it. Then what happened was, what came out after President Ford left, President President Carter, we began to decontrol and get rid of all the stuff administratively. And then, as I recall, when President Reagan came in, we issued the final thing that killed, stabbed that snake. But I mean, it was. Now, when you say political, I think the career people that were doing this didn't think it was political, although we might got help every once in a while upstairs. But by and large, I don't think they thought it was political. They were looking at a massive amount of data that didn't, I mean, and so was there some value judgments in it? Yes. Whether I think that whole allocation program was done as political, I think there's some big groups who come in and give you words. But the problem is you had all these conflicting needs for a limited amount of resources, and the staff did it. And what we set up was an unbelievable thing called the exceptions process, a series of regs. And boy, if there's anything great for the lobbying thing in Washington, was the exception process. Because it set up this, and if you thought you were aggrieved, you could petition the government for one of these releases. And people would be running in, not us, into the earned income. So I think there's a lot of people that worked on it didn't think it was all that political, but it was very value-laden, yes.
Well, there are two parts of allocation. One was based on historical receipts.
Right.
And each state had an allocation based upon its historical usage. Then there were the special interest groups who came in, starting with the hospitals. We need fuel for our ambulances. And then it worked down through the truckers, and every special interest group had a shot at an exception. The consequence of all of this was that you had allocated on a regional basis, on a state basis, based upon past usage. And of course, the nature of an energy crisis is that demand and supply shift. So you were imposing an allocation system that was based frequently on totally irrelevant things. Those rural states had large allocations. Urban states or semi-urban states had small allocations. They all came in and demanded more. Keep the government out of the allocation business.
Oh, it was cemented because there was something called a supplier purchase rule where we had to maintain, as the secretary said, all the relationships as a certain day. I think it was 1973. There's a little problem. How do you know what those relationships were in the volumes of every possible supplier that buys all? I mean, you're talking about a huge database, and people had to work through there and put a database together of how much certain people had. It was unbelievable. And how did we know when they were sending the data and the reporting numbers were right? Really unbelievable.
If I can go back to one thing that Jim Schlesinger said a minute ago on Project Independence. The president came out for something he called Project Independence. Everybody subsequently, every president subsequently, has had the same mantra, and Jim is exactly right. The chances of producing it in the way it is understood are effectively zero. But how did President Nixon come up with it? Well, if you read his speech, and if you read his memoirs afterward, he said the country needs something to energize it, something to hold up to, something to go after, and so he used two analogies. He said, we can make this like Project Apollo, we can make this like the creation of the atomic bomb in the Manhattan Initiative. And so these will capture the American attention and give us something to shoot for, and we'll do it in 10 years, just like Jack Kennedy said, we'll go to the moon in 10 years. And so us silly little fellows doing drafts of this energy speech would do drafts of it, and we'd send it across West Executive Avenue from the old executive office building where we were working over into the West Wing, and it would disappear into the labyrinth of the West Wing. And it kept coming back after we had edited out this crazy thought of Project Independence, with it popping back in there. And after about three times that happened, I called the chief of staff over there, and I said, what in the world is happening? Who is putting in this strange phrase, Project Independence? And he said, this is Haldeman. Haldeman says, it's the old man. Right, so they elected him, they didn't elect us, so we put it in there. And then the staff had to come out and do fact sheets on all these presidential statements to down to the smallest little detail of all these things you've been hearing from the two Jims to my left. And thank God I had hired the smartest person at OMB, with all due deference to my friend Tozzi, to be my fact man. And he would sit there until 2 o'clock in the morning, wrestle all the other bureaucracies to the ground, and then finally he would go home like a dog with his bone in his teeth saying, "We did it, boss." And that was a guy, I don't know whatever happened to him, lost in the mist of obscurity. His name is Jim Schlady. And he is sitting right back here. That's why I'm being particularly funny about him. And I remember Glenn Schlady having to write the fact sheet on the energy speech. And I said, "What are you going to write about how we're doing Project Independence?" He says, "I don't know." And so even though that was the headline, that was what everybody remembers from the speech, that's what the president wanted to hold up there as the torch, nobody knew how to do it substantively. Those on the inside, those on the outside, and as a matter of fact, as Secretary Schlesinger says, there wasn't any way to do it.
It was a.
If you want to look at the numbers, in 1974, when the speech was first made, we were importing 3 million barrels of oil a day. The goal was to have self-sufficiency by 1980. By the year 1980, we were importing 6 million barrels of oil a day, which was not a total success in achieving energy independence.
There was another very controversial allocation in a way. It was basically a trade restrictions, the mandatory oil import program, which had been instituted in 1959 by President Eisenhower at the time, responding to concern over imports. That survived up until it was lifted by the President Nixon in 1973. But there was a commission,
Schultz Commission,
appointed by President Nixon. I think it was probably 70 or 71. And as a good Chicago economist, the Secretary Schultz conclusion was that we should lift this because it unnecessarily protects our domestic industry and inhibits free trade. The memoirs and books say the president was in favor of accepting Secretary Schultz's recommendation, but yet he chose not to. What was that, just politics or?
I was the observer for the old Bureau of the Budget on that committee. And you had Schultz on the one hand, and his professor from the Harvard Law School, who was...
John Dunlop, I think?
No, he was later on in labor. Both of them pushing for freeing up imports, which it was getting ridiculous, because the Saudis could produce oil at 50 cents a barrel, and we were producing oil in this country at $8 a barrel or some such number as that in order to draw in additional investment. Also on the committee was Wally Hickel, governor of Alaska, who had all of his oil up there on the Arctic Ocean, which was not entirely accessible. And he wanted protection for his state. He was not in favor of letting his state be ruined by a bunch of damn Middle Easterners. So the fight raged within the committee. And as usual in such a committee, the chairman won.
But obviously, because price controls continued, as Jim Tozzi pointed out, this internal inconsistency where you're keeping out the less expensive oil, producing more expensive oil, and yet...
We were subsidizing imports, yes.
What we did, though, yeah, we did that, exactly. But over time, those quotas starting to change for reasons...
Exceptions.
There were exceptions that didn't go to the bosses a lot. And there was just a way the government... You know, when things really get bad, the government can fix things one way to make the trains run. And the career staff made some of that run, whether it was completely a lot of policy or not. But oil started to come in because there was the exceptions process, And there's not a lot written of who initiates the request.
Subsidizing.
It was subsidizing.
We were using American oil producers by holding down their prices to subsidize imported oil from the people who had imposed the quota on us. That's the way governments work, by the way.
Well, maybe now we can turn to the Yom Kippur War and ultimately, a couple weeks later, the imposition of the WAPEC embargo. There already were some signals to this that there were concerns about our pro-Israeli policy.
King Faisal had written us a letter back there in about March of 73, in which he said, the situation in the Middle East is intolerable. Something is going to happen unless you take action. So as usual, we just regarded this as bombast. And it turned out that it wasn't bombast. The Yom Kippur War came along. We, the intelligence community, was split on this. NSA had it right, the National Security Agency. It said, something is going to happen out there. We see all of this movement. Whereas the Central Intelligence Agency, if I may remind you, said quite clearly, nothing is going to happen. It's all noise. It turned out it wasn't noise. So when war came, the Israelis, who had assured us they wouldn't dare attack, an underestimation. They were attacked, and they were under real pressure for a while. They were concerned that they would run out of munitions because they had only stocked munitions based on the day of supply from the 1967 war, which went a lot more favorably than the 73 war. So at that point, we had to start shipping to Israel munitions. Then subsequently, the president asked the Congress to grant additional funds to Israel so that they could pay for this stuff. And at that point, the Arabs imposed the embargo.
So we weren't really, were we already having bilateral talks with the Saudis and
we
others at that time?
We were having bilateral talks with our friends and our opponents. Our friends, of course, with the Shah, who took advantage of the situation to shove up the price of oil, while the Saudis were trying to control it, they being our opponents. One of those great ironies of history. And the Saudis worked fairly hard to end the embargo early in 1974. I think that one great lesson of the embargo is that it's a boomerang. The oil weapon is exaggerated. It can be used temporarily, but ultimately it is a boomerang. And as a result of the embargo and the actions taken by consumer nations, the amount of oil shipped by OPEC gradually diminished. And since Saudi Arabia was underwriting the holding up the price of oil, its share of the market fell to about 1 million barrels a day in the mid-1980s, at which point they said, the hell with our role as price controller, we are going to start producing. And then the price of oil plummeted.
One of the other initiatives of President Nixon during this period, of course, was to use this moment of angst among the consuming nations to set up what has turned into the International Energy Agency. And he designated Secretary Kissinger to convoke a meeting of the major oil-consuming countries, both to share data and to come together with joint policies so that we would have something on the other side from OPEC. And although it wasn't wildly important or successful for ab initio, over time, it has proved to be something that people still think is worthwhile and we still pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah,
it was intended as a counterpoint to OPEC.
Exactly.
Initially. Ultimately, it became an arrangement for cooperative discussion so that both the consuming countries and the producing countries could at least understand what they were trying to achieve.
And what the statistics were internationally on which to base their policies and programs.
If you could believe the lying statistics.
Well, we've already, and Dick's already gone into a little bit of discussion about that Project Independence speech, if we call that, which is the was the speech that the president gave in response to the embargo in an attempt to mobilize the American public. And we do have a clip of that speech that I think might provide a little, even a little more flavor here. November 7th, 1973.
And of the earlier Manhattan Project are the same lessons that are taught by the whole of American history. Whenever the American people are faced with a clear goal and they're challenged to meet it, extraordinary things. Today, the challenge is to regain the strength we had earlier in this century, the strength of self-sufficiency. Our ability to meet our own energy needs is directly limited to our continued ability to act decisively and independently at home and abroad in the service of peace, not only for America,
back?
But for all nations
roll the
in the world.
Back?
The lessons of the Apollo Project and of the earlier Manhattan Project are the same lessons that are taught by the whole of American history. Whenever the American people are faced with a clear goal and they're challenged to meet it, we can do extraordinary things. Today, the challenge is to regain the strength we had earlier in this century, the strength of self-sufficiency. Our ability to meet our own energy needs is directly limited to our continued ability to act decisively and independently at home and abroad in the service of peace, not only for America, but for all nations in the world. I have ordered funding of this effort to achieve self-sufficiency far in excess of the funds that were expended on the Manhattan Project. But money is only one of the ingredients essential to the success of such a project. We must also have a unified commitment to that goal. We must have unified direction of the effort to accomplish it. Because of the urgent need for an organization that would provide focused leadership for this effort, I am asking the Congress to consider my proposal for an Energy Research and Development Administration, separate from any other organizational initiatives, and to enact this legislation in the present session of the Congress. Let us unite in committing the resources of this nation to a major new endeavor, an endeavor that in this bicentennial era we can appropriately call Project Independence. Let us set as our national goal, in the spirit of Apollo, with the determination of the Manhattan Project, that by the end of this decade, we will have developed the potential to meet our own energy needs without depending on any foreign energy sources. Let us pledge that by 1980, under Project Independence, we shall be able to meet America's energy needs from America's own energy resources.
And we are doing this for all nations of the world, including the oil exporting nations.
Is that the end, Alex?
That's the end.
Okay. The one thing, I don't know if anyone was noticing, but there you could see actually on the written, as the president reached the end of that speech, there were a lot of handwritten notes on that. And what wasn't on that tape is he concluded by saying, now there has been a lot of talk in the media about the Watergate issue, and I just want to inform you, make the announcement that I have no intention to resign. Now, that was November 7th, 1973. But it was in the midst of a crisis, and obviously there was a long way to go with respect to implementing the proposal he makes in that, proposals he makes in that speech. Just maybe to at least wrap up that part of this, how big a role or how much of a political obstacle was the Watergate issue in dealing with the immediacy of this energy crisis for, in your different, all three of your positions? I mean, what did, was that a big obstacle to passing the legislation?
Oh, I think it clearly was an obstacle to passing the legislation. The Congress was out of sorts, as we've already said. Both houses were in control of a different party of Congress, and the president's bully pulpit was muted because he had to talk in a major speech again about he wasn't going to resign. But as far as the people working on it, I mean, we didn't get to the office every day and say, geez, we've got to worry about Watergate, because we were worrying about, as you can tell, a very broad agenda of things, as we said earlier, personnel and policy and institutions, which required our full-time efforts. Now, that doesn't mean that the fellows who we were reporting to across West Executive, Ehrlichmans and Haldemans and the president himself and things like that, as we know from the tapes, they were spending a large amount of their time and a lot of their internal energies fighting the fires of Watergate, but not the substantive staffers. As Jim says, the professional staff and us secondary political staff people kind of washed over our heads.
Yeah, I don't think it affected us at all. In fact, as Watergate became more and more important, I was struck by the amount of gravity of big decisions that went to OMB. I mean, I was involved in things that I never thought I'd be involved in. So, but the career staff and what we were doing on us, I don't think we're affected at all.
Look, the Middle Eastern war came about. The Russians threatened to move forces into the Middle East. We responded with the nuclear alert, to which there was this upcry. And at the same time, Elliot Richardson resigned. We had a subsequent resignation by
Ruckelshaus.
And the consequence was there was an uproar in, I guess, or in February, I guess it was, of 74. November of 70. And the first demands for impeachment came at that point. And it was the cries for impeachment that did the problem, did the trouble. So indirectly, one can talk about the oil embargo and the Middle Eastern problems, but it was the domestic problems that really weakened President Nixon.
I think that's all.
Thank you. I just have, do we have time for one?
Yeah.
One more question. That was, as a final thing, kind of, what were the lessons learned? What do you think we did right? And maybe some things that were less effective. Dick?
Well, I think Jim Tozzi has put his finger on what I think the one negative lesson learned is, don't try to run a large program from the seat of power here in Washington. This is too large and diverse a country. There are too many moving parts. Nobody is smart enough to be able to handle micromanaging something certainly as difficult as energy, or as price controls, or the American economy from a central position. And therefore, the ability of the federal government to do particular things, I think we can all have a takeaway saying there are some things that are beyond the power, competence, and ability, even if we thought it were the right thing to do, which I certainly don't, but that one was proved to be a non-starter substantively. As far as things that went right, again, as Jim Schlesinger had pointed out earlier, if you go back to the 71 speech and the 73 speech, and you see the entire outline of what President Nixon laid out, both research and development, conservation, substantive programs in all the areas that the people have talked about ever since, Department of Energy and Natural Resources, IRDA, all of the institutions, all of the substantive areas were all begun to be addressed, put on the national agenda very early in the game by the first president even to see the issue. And so looking over the horizon, trying to be in front of issues, trying to look at what those implications are substantively and in terms of institutions and of personnel is something that that I think that the president was rightly applauded for at the time, and something that we can keep trying to do as we look at today's problems. The most difficult thing about today's problems is to see the implication for tomorrow. And although it's difficult to do, that's one of the most important jobs that can be done by the government.
What we have learned is something that we learned in World War II, that under wartime conditions or crisis conditions, one has a need for the strategic materials that one has to import from abroad. The way to deal with that is insurance, and we created the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in that period, and the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is the most useful element in dealing with potential interruptions that we have found. Don't fiddle around with price controls. Don't have mandatory controls.
I agree with my two colleagues of what we did right and wrong. My concern is I think a lot of people won't watch the CSIS tape out of this thing. Not that we're brilliant, we're just telling you what happened. And I feel they'll discard it and we'll start again and we're in another mess.
Right.
A note of optimism.
We could go on.
The only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. Right.
One item as we close, it's a matter of personal privilege. I produce these, this is our 13th one. These are my colleagues from before. What was so different about the Nixon administration? What causes us to be able to go back and say, see what they did, see what they thought, see how important it is today? And we did this in our first forum, and we described the change, but it's important to bring it up again because it's echoed here. There was a significant institutional change that occurred with the Nixon administration. It was the conversion from the old Bureau of the Budget to the Office of Management and Budget to expect performance out of the government, not just adding the numbers. And the best of the civil service system, the elite people, were in first BOB and then OMB. And they were, it's career staff, but it was the creme de la creme. And the other thing that was created at the same time, the same reorganization plan, number two of 1970, was the Domestic Council. And what it still exists today, it's called the Domestic Policy Council, but what was done was they brought into the office of the president domestic policy and analysis as a parallel to the National Security Council. And it's the foundation of the modern presidency. It's the beginning of saying the cabinet, which used to be cabinet government, the cabinet now has input, but policy is made in the White House and the cabinet executes. So, and it started in the next administration. So when you trace back any subject, at welfare or education or energy, and these are issues for which there's no permanent solution, you can go back to the Nixon people who first analyzed it from a national perspective on behalf of the president rather than an individual department. And when Dick, who was on the Domestic Council, Jim was on OMB, and while Jim was out in the departments, he started in BOB and went from there to AEC. So we trained him. See, we take credit. We take credit for Jim. It has been a thrill to do.
Yeah, well, I knew all your tricks.
Thank you all for coming. Have a pleasant afternoon.